ebooks! Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing the story of the Wars of the Roses, beginning with basically Henry VI. So if you remember last time, we left off talking all about that sort of stuff. Let's just carry on straight away. If you remember last time, we'd got to the point roughly where there'd been some blood drawn on both sides, the Lancastrian side with King Henry VI, who's infirmed and feeble-minded, and his wife, Margaret of Anjou, and the various people around him, Suffolk. They'd got rid of the Duke of Gloucester, the king's uncle, Henry V's younger brother. They'd humiliated his wife, and then they'd arrested him, and then he died very shortly after being arrested. That was sort of first blood, sort of. It goes back before that, of course, but let's say that sort of first blood. Then they struck back. Suffolk himself was disgraced. The people didn't like him, and in the end, the king, he was going to be executed, a bill of attainder from Parliament, but the king just exiled him. And then while he was going to exile, literally while he was on the ship crossing the channel into exile, he was captured by another ship, or another Royal Navy ship, and executed. So he's gone, right? And then, do you remember, we talked a bit about the rebellion of Jack Cade, just some random normal soldier dude who tried to rise up against the Lancastrians. And then that's where we were. That's sort of basically where we got to. I let Professor Charles O'Mahon talk all about the different sides, you know, laying out basically who was in the Yorkist camp and who's in the Lancastrian camp and all that sort of thing. I'll continue reading from Professor Sir Charles O'Mahon, an early 20th century Oxford professor of history, one of the very best to ever do it, as well as Winston Churchill in his History of the English-Speaking Peoples. I'll just give you a quick, super quick recap about Jack Cade, what Churchill says about Jack Cade. It's literally one short paragraph. So I'll read that and then we'll continue the story on from there with completely new and fresh things. Okay, Churchill says, "In June and July, a rising took place in Kent, which the Lancastrians claimed to bear the marks of Yorkist support. Jack Cade, a soldier of capacity and bad character, home from the wars, gathered several thousand men, all summoned in due form by the constables of the district, and marched on London. He was admitted to the city, but on his executing Lord Say, the treasurer, in Cheapside, after a mob trial, the magistrates and citizens turned against him, his followers dispersed under terms of pardon, and he himself was pursued and killed. This success, for the Lancastrians, basically, restored for the moment the authority of the government, and Henry," that's King Henry VI, the feeble-minded king, "and Henry enjoyed a brief interlude in which he devoted himself anew to his colleges at Eton and Cambridge, and Margaret, his wife, Margaret of Anjou, who had gained his love and obedience." But it doesn't last long. Let Churchill continue with what's happening in France, because if you remember, the whole, especially the beginning part of the Wars of the Roses, is very, very, very much wrapped up in the story of England finally losing the Hundred Years' War in France, finally getting entirely kicked out of France other than Calais. It's all wrapped up in the same thing. A lot of the reasons why Henry VI, why his reign was so troubled, is because we were just kind of endlessly losing in France. If you're endlessly winning, like his father, Henry V, then everything's good and rosy and no one dares sort of challenge you or question your authority or anything. If it's the other way around, yeah. And if you're weak and feeble, doubly so. Okay, let's listen to Churchill talk about what was going down in France around this time. And we're talking the very, very late 1440s, early 1450s at this point, around the year 1450, 51. So Churchill says, quote, "As the process of expelling the English from France continued, fortresses fell, towns and districts were lost, and their garrisons for the most part came home. The speed of this disaster contributed powerfully to shock English opinion and to shake not only the position of individual ministers, but the very foundations of the Lancastrian dynasty." I.e., there was always the old argument that the Lancastrians were usurpers, that the first of the Lancastrian kings, Henry IV, Henry Bolingbroke, had basically illegally, according to their enemies, had illegally arrested, imprisoned, and quite possibly murdered his own cousin, Richard II, the true heir, the true Plantagenet heir, the son of the Black Prince, who was the son of Edward III. And that at that point, everything that happened since then, the whole reign of Henry IV and Henry V and now Henry VI, all of that was wrong and illegal, say their enemies, right? Say the Yorkists. And that argument had never, ever disappeared or gone away. Well, now it's coming out in force, as you can imagine, with us, the English, doing so terribly in France. You know, God wants it that way. If we're losing, it's God, because God wants it. It works the other way as well, right? If you keep winning, it's because God wills it. God's on your side. Well, if you're losing, he's displeased with you. Perhaps your entire monarchy, your entire dynasty. Okay, Churchill continues saying, with incredible folly and bad faith, the English broke the truce at Forgeres in March 1449. By August 1450, the whole of Normandy was lost. By August 1451, the whole of Gascony, which had been English for three centuries, had been lost as well, and all of the conquests of Henry V, which had taken England 11 years of toil and blood to win, and only Calais remained. Edmund Beaufort, the king's commander, friend and Lancastrian cousin, bore the blame for unbroken defeat, and this reacted on the king himself. England became full of what we should call ex-servicemen, who did not know why they had been beaten, but were sure that they had been mishandled and had fought in vain. The nobles, in the increasing disorder, were glad to gather these hardened fighters to their local defence. All the great houses kept bands of armed retainers, sometimes almost amounting to private armies. So that's a big thing, end quote, me again. And so that's a really important element to all of this to remember. I said it in the last couple of episodes, a couple of times, I have to keep repeating it, that the Wars of the Roses are born out of the Hundred Years' War. The Hundred Years' War peters out and ends, essentially. But it's a militarised age. And Churchill talks about them being ex-servicemen. Yeah, so there's loads of soldiers, veteran soldiers, that are now just in England, twiddling their thumbs. So it's a martial age, and they're expected to fight. They know nothing other than fighting. So their energies have to go somewhere. Well, in a sense, you can say the energy, the military energy of the Hundred Years' War transfers over into the Cousins' War, the Wars of the Roses. Okay, let's let Churchill continue. He says, they, the noblemen, the noble people of England, they gave them, the ex-servicemen, gave them pay and land, or both, and uniforms or liveries bearing the family crest. The Earl of Warwick, perhaps the greatest landowner, who aspired to a leading part in politics, had thousands of dependents who ate what was called his bread, quote, his bread. He paid for them, basically. So they're loyal to him, personally. And of these, a large proportion were organised troops proud to display the badge of the Bear and the Ragged Staff, either the House of Warwick, one branch of the Nevilles. Other magnates emulated this example according to their means. Cash and ambition ruled, and the land sank rapidly towards anarchy. The king was a helpless creature. This is a key line here, key bit of historical data. The king was a helpless creature, respected, even beloved, but no prop for any man. Parliament, both Lords and Commons, was little more than a clearinghouse for the rivalries of nobles, end quote. Now that says a lot right there, and bear that in mind, because if that wasn't the case, that last sentence there, the last two sentences there from Churchill, if that wasn't the case, the Wars of the Roses wouldn't have been possible. If there'd been a strong government, a strong king, a strong parliament, it wouldn't have happened. But it's individual nobles like Richard, Duke of York, like the Earl of Warwick, if they weren't powers, true powers in and of themselves, in their own right, completely independent of the crown, completely independent of parliament, if that wasn't the case, then the Wars of the Roses wouldn't have happened. But it is the case. It's like a perfect storm of various things happened, right? The Hundred Years' War's petering out, and there's endless soldiers now just all across the country. The king is completely feckless and inept. There's various nobles that have got similar levels of power. Again, if there was one overarching, overpowerful earl, then maybe the Wars of the Roses wouldn't have happened because, okay, the king isn't in control of policy. The king doesn't control government. Okay, this other guy does. You know, someone like Godwin in the age of Edward the Confessor, say. One overarchingly powerful magnate, but it's not. There's all sorts of them, loads of them, and they're rivals, blood rivals, and ambitious for power in their own right. So, yeah, a number of things came together to make this happen. Churchill goes on saying, a statute of 1429, i.e. a while before this, had fixed the country franchise at the 40 shilling freeholder, i.e. there was a money property qualification before you're allowed any sort of say in politics. It is hard to realise that this arbitrarily contracted franchise ruled in England for 400 years and that all the wars and quarrels, the decision of the greatest causes, the grandest events at home and abroad, proceeded upon this basis until the Reform Bill of 1832. In the preamble to the original Act, it was alleged that the participation of elections of too great a number of people of little substance or worth, quote, had led to homicides, riots, assaults and frauds. So was a backward but endearing step taken in parliamentary representation. Yet never for centuries had the privilege of Parliament stood so high. Never for centuries was it more blatantly exploited. So Churchill just telling us there a little bit about Parliament. That's what he does in the history of the English-speaking peoples. He quite often takes a moment out just to give you, just to touch base with Parliament, what's going on with the history of Parliament. So there he tells us a little bit about what it meant, that it's sort of important. If there's not a super strong king that can just override it entirely, like Edward III, maybe, although he didn't override it entirely. Go back and watch my videos about Edward III. But if you've got someone like Henry V or Edward I, or even someone like Charles I in when he had his personal rule, if you've got a strong enough king, for whatever reason, doesn't want to or doesn't need to really listen to Parliament much in the Middle Ages, then they don't have to. But then sometimes if you've got a super weak king like this, Henry VI, Parliament may well come into its own. But at least in the middle of the 15th century, it's just completely exploited. I mean, Churchill called it, what, little more than a clearinghouse for the rivalries of nobles. Okay, another paragraph here. Churchill says, the force of law was appropriated by intrigue, baronial violence, used or defied legal forms with growing impunity. I.e. these nobles like Richard Duke of York are a law unto themselves. They really are. Or their retainers, their men, can go around doing rapes and murders and things, whatever. And there's no repercussions. The law of the land, the writ of the king, doesn't have any power. So they're truly laws unto themselves. Church. The constitution was turned against the public. No man was safe in life or lands, or even in the humblest right, except through the protection of his local chief. The celebrated Paston letters, and there's a family, the Pastons, who wrote loads of letters, and they survive remarkably. And they talk all about everyday things, sometimes sort of everyday things. And they certainly talk about what's going on in the country. And it's a remarkable piece of evidence because for one of the first times, it's sort of relatively normal people. I mean, the Pastons are not poor peasants at all. They're firmly what we might call now middle class or upper middle class, something like that. But they're not the actual Lancastrian or Yorkish families. They're sort of effectively normal people, kind of normal people. And so their letters, many, 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 many letters, they talk about all different things, writing to their other relatives and friends and things. And it's just a great insight, a great window into what was really going on and what normal people might have thought and felt about it. Again, from earlier times, from earlier centuries, we have nothing like it. There's nothing like it from the 11th century, right? So, for example, or earlier, of course, very rarely, very rarely. And so it's something like Cicero's letters, the first century BC, Marcus Tullius Cicero writing letters to his friends. Some of those survive. That's why that's so incredible. You have to go nearly a 1,500 years later, a millennium and a half later, before you get something along those lines, with some other exceptions along the way. But okay, Churchill says, the celebrated Paston letters show that England, enormously advanced as it was in comprehension, character and civilization, was relapsing from peace and security into barbaric confusion. The roads were insecure. That's a classic thing all through the centuries. Is it safe to go on the public highways? Is it safe to travel around between towns and cities, particularly at night? Is it safe or not? It's quite a simple litmus test, isn't it? Well, at this stage, we're told, it seems, that it's not. It's becoming less safe. The roads were insecure, Churchill said. The king's writ was denied or perverted. The royal judges were flouted or bribed. The rights of sovereignty were stated in the highest terms, but the king was a weak and handled fool. The powers of Parliament could be turned this way and that according to the factions that gripped it. Yet the suffering, toiling, unconquerable community had moved far from the days of Stephen and Maud, i.e. the anarchy of the 12th century, had moved far from the days of Stephen and Maud and Henry II and Thomas Becket and of King John and the barons. There was a highly complex society, still growing in spite of evils in many regions. The poverty of the executive, the king, the difficulties of communication, and the popular strength in bills and bows, bills like hooks, the popular strength in weapons, all helped to hold it in balance. There was a public opinion. There was a collective moral sense. There were venerated customs. Above all, there was a national spirit. And so Churchill painting a picture there of an England with a relatively, as he says it, for the 15th century, relatively complex civil society. That's sort of what he's describing, isn't it? A civil society. You know, if you believe the Paston letters, and there's absolutely no reason not to believe them, to be fair, right? So It's not a really simple feudal society like the 11th century, 12th century. It's more complex. So something like private armies, the private armies of Warwick, say, are possible. If the king isn't strong enough to keep the kingdom in check, someone else will do it. All right, let's flip over to Sir Charles Oman, where he starts telling us about, we've got a bit here about the general character of the Wars of the Roses. Oman, in the early 20th century, or very, very, very late 19th century, wrote this, quote, "The Wars of the Roses, as historians have chosen to name them, from the White Rose, which was the badge of York, and the Red Rose, which was assumed long after as the emblem of Lancaster, were much more than a faction fight between two rival coteries of peers. At the first, they were the attempt of the majority of the English nation to oust an unpopular minister from power by force of arms." Suffolk, we're talking about there. William de la Pole. "There is no doubt that the greater part of England sided with York in this endeavour against the king and Margaret of Anjou and Suffolk. The citizens," a reference to maybe Jack Cade's rebellion as well, perhaps, "the citizens and freeholders of London, Kent and the South and the Midlands, where lay all the wealth and political energy of the nation, were strongly Yorkist. Henry, on the other hand," obviously Lancastrian, Archland, the head, the titular head, the nominal head of the Lancastrians, "Henry, on the other hand, got his support from a group of great nobles who controlled the Wild West and North, and the still wilder Wales. Unfortunately for the nation, the constitutional aspect of the struggle was gradually obscured by the increasing bitterness of family blood feuds. Thy father slew mine, and now will I slay thee, was the cry of the Lancastrian noble to the enemy who asked for quarter. And it expresses well enough the whole aspect of the later years of the struggle, i.e. blood feud, blood vendetta, that regardless of anything, at some point, when civil wars happen and things like this, at some point, regardless of politics, regardless of how doomed your cause is or anything, regardless of the justice of it, you killed my dad, so I'm going to kill your dad now. You killed my brother, so I'm going to kill your brother now. You stole my estates, raped my women folk, so I'm going to kill you now." It just boils down to that, you know, quite quickly. Or in this case, not quite quickly. Over a number of years it played out, but there you go. "Thy father slew mine, and now I will slay thee." There you go, in a nutshell. Okay, Oman continues saying this. "The war commenced with an attempt to set right by force the government of the realm, but it ended as a mere series of bloody reprisals for slain kinsfolk. It left England in a far worse state from the political and constitutional point of view than it had known since the days of John," you know, King John in the very, very early 13th century, late 12th century, early 13th century. Again, a type of civil war, social, political collapse, really. Something close to an anarchy, if not actual anarchy. So, bad times. "It began with the comparatively small affliction of a weak, well-intentioned king who persisted in retaining an unpopular minister in power." Again, Suffolk, you know, the one that was trying to cross the channel, got caught, got, and then got beheaded. "It ended by leaving the realm in the hands of an arbitrary, self-willed king who ruled autocratically for himself, with no desire or intention of consulting the nation's wishes as to how it should be governed," end quote. So just to let you know, just to jump ahead a bit here, to let you know what was being said there, and that to keep it in mind, because it will help you understand everything that's going on, because the Wars of the Roses really is complicated. It really, really is. There's so many characters in it, so many people in it, so many back and forth, so many battles, that if you don't pin certain characters in your mind, who they are, then it will just be too confusing. I'll just keep naming these people and you won't know who's who and you'll forget. So now let me introduce, arguably, the most important figure in this. Second most important. Let's say the most important figure is King Henry VI, the feeble-minded king, the feeble-minded Lancastrian king, okay? He's the most important figure, right? You can use him as an anchor point of where he is, who controls him, what's he doing, okay? Then, all right, so the second most important figure in all of this will be the next king after him, who is Edward IV, introducing King Edward IV. Okay, that's who Oman was referring to there when he said the whole Wars of the Roses ended with an arbitrary, self-willed king who ruled autocratically for himself with no desire or intention of consulting the nation's wishes and how it should be governed. Edward IV. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Edward IV so that you can have him in your mind, that person, that figure, and you can anchor various things around him, various events around him. He's like the Arch-Yorkist, okay? So I've talked a fair bit about Richard, Duke of York. He is one of the cousins, you know. He's Henry the Sixth cousin. Really, his line has got a better claim to the throne than the Lancastrian family. He's descended of the Edward III's second son, the Duke of Clarence, whereas the Lancastrians are descended from the third son, John of Gaunt. So Richard, Duke of York, is a middle-aged man. He's already been in wars in Ireland and in France. He's a middle-aged, very, very competent man, Richard, Duke of York. If anyone was to take over the crown from the feeble King Henry VI, it would be him, okay? Now, we'll talk all about exactly what happens to him and his fate and why he doesn't end up becoming king. We'll talk all about that when the time comes. But just to mention, he had three sons. The eldest one is called Edward. That kid, still a kid at this point, when the Wars of the Roses break out, is like 17 years old, 18 years old. He's young, old enough in these days. He's a man. He's a full-grown man. He can go and fight in battles. He's a full-grown man. He's not a child, but still he's young, 17, 18, 19 odd. The eldest of these sons of York, Edward, he's the one that goes on to ultimately become King Edward IV, right? So we're not going to talk about him much for a while, maybe an episode or two. He won't really come into the story much for a while yet. It was all about his dad, Richard, Duke of York. It's all about him still for a long time. But just bear in mind, the Duke of York's eldest son, Edward, ends up the ultimate victor of it all. Okay, well, not the ultimate victor. Henry Tudor is the ultimate victor at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485. He's the ultimate winner, isn't he? But nonetheless, remember this Edward and all the boys, these sons of York. Very famous Shakespeare line. Okay, these sons in splendour. Okay, let's let Oman tell us a bit more then. He goes on to say, quote, "We might place the beginning of the Wars of the Roses at the moment of Cade's insurrection." Remember Jack Cade, that wannabe soldier who marched on London and killed the treasurer, Lord Say, in Cheapside, and then himself got thrown out of London and eventually killed. Cade's insurrection, but it was not till 5 years later that the struggle broke out in its bitterer form. Strangely enough, the commencement of the strife was preceded by a time in which it seemed almost certain that the troubles of the realm would blow over. Remember Churchill talking about how there was an interlude there where King Henry VI could just spend his time building his colleges at Eton and Cambridge and spending time with his wife. That's that time, this sort of 5 years or so. Okay, it seemed like maybe the country wouldn't descend into some form of civil war. But Oman says, in 1453, the king went mad. So if you remember, I talked all about how his madness, you know, what today we would call mental illness, it would come and go. When he was young, it often wasn't too bad, but it seemed to get worse as he got older, or the periods of it lasted longer. Sometimes he was fine. I mean, even when he was completely lucid and fine and not suffering from any sort of episode, even then he was weak-willed and weak-minded. But then he would have, I mean, can we call them episodes? Sometimes he would have episodes where he would just, selective mutism, just stare at the wall, not say anything, not respond to anyone. He would still eat. You could sort of move him around, put him in a chair, and he'd just sit there in complete silence, just staring into the space. You could put him in bed, and he'd fall asleep. You could put food in his mouth, and he'd chew, and he'd swallow it. But nothing beyond that. As he got older, that started to happen. And as the years went by, it got worse and worse and worse, lasted longer and longer and longer. You know? And then he'll just snap out of it. Sometimes towards the end, or from years from now, sometimes it would last weeks and weeks, if not months. Months he was in that state. And then one day, like one moment, he'll just snap out of it. Just be like, oh wait, what's going on? What's happened now? Like that, and pretend, or not pretend, he's suffering from a mental illness. He would say he didn't know anything that happened in the last few months. Like one time his wife was pregnant, he starts one of these episodes, the kid is born, and then he snaps out of it months later. He's like, oh, what? I've got a baby? Well, how did that happen? Where did that come from? Sort of thing. So there's no other way to describe it than true mental illness. So, okay. The last thing you need in a king in a martial age. Terrible thing. All right. Oman says, in 1453, the king went mad. The peers and commons unanimously called upon York, that is Richard, Duke of York, the father of the one day King Edward IV. So they called upon York Richard Duke of York, as the first Prince of the Blood, i.e. he was a very, very senior member of the royal family, arguably a better claimant to the throne than the king himself, the first Prince of the Blood to take up the place of Protector of the Realm, i.e. to be a king in all but name, to be a Lord Protector, to be a regent. You know, like, say you've got a tiny baby, is like Henry VI used to be. You need a protector of the realm to actually govern, to actually do the business of government. So the commons, the peers and commons, wanted Richard Duke of York to do that. But remember, Margaret of Anjou and the whole faction, the whole Lancastrian faction around the king, they're not going to like that. They're not going to be happy with that. They won't really accept that because he's their arch enemy, right? Already the two sides have bumped off someone or other from the other side's faction. Already it's something close to all-out war, one way or another. All right, so the fact that the peers and the commons wanted the Duke of York, which is the obvious choice, it would have been the obvious choice. He's a senior statesman. He's a tried and tested military commander. He's the first Prince of the Blood, etc., etc. He's the obvious choice. But the Lancastrians are not going to like that. Oman continues saying, he did so, i.e. Richard Duke of York taking up the role of being protector of the realm, he did so to the general satisfaction of the nation. Again, like, you know, he's a competent man. And he cast Somerset into the Tower. Somerset, one of the leading men in the Lancastrian faction. He cast him into the Tower and replaced the old ministers with more capable men, i.e. a lot of the men the Henry VI had picked or had picked on his behalf, were running the country into the ground, apparently, according to Yorkists. You know, they'd lost everything in France. It was their fault. So once Richard Duke of York gets his chance at running government, because the king's gone mad, he gets rid of them all, puts them in the Tower, or just simply replaces them. Oman goes on saying, but just as all seemed settled and York's ultimate succession to the crown appeared inevitable, you know, like at what point would he just say the king's mad, he can't do anything, I am king now, you know, pull a Bolingbroke. Just put the king himself in the Tower and then he'll probably die one way or another quickly. No one ever hears from him again. The crown is vacant and it's now the Duke of York who is just the king now. He would be Richard III, wouldn't he? We do have a Richard III in not too long in this story, but it's not this one. It's his son, his second son. Well, actually, sorry, the third son. Richard III is this Richard Duke of York's third son. But we'll get on to that. Already I'm confusing matters. We'll get on to that. We'll leave that for later. Okay, but this Richard Duke of York, it was thought at this point that his ultimate succession to the crown appeared inevitable. The whole aspect of affairs was altered by the Queen, Margaret of Anjou, remember, a French woman of Anjou, the weak-minded Henry VI's wife. The whole aspect of affairs was altered by the Queen giving birth to a son after 9 years of unfruitful wedlock. So that does change everything, because if Henry VI, the weak-minded king, if he had, for whatever reason, been put in some remote castle somewhere, like Pembroke Castle or something, and then just never seen again, like 6 months, a year later, the news comes out, oh, he died. He died of natural causes. He's dead. Anyway, here's the new king, right? Things like that had already happened before. Richard II, Edward II, things like that had happened. If that happened, well, it all would be quite neat and squared away. But now he's got a son. Well, if Richard Duke of York or the Yorkists wanted to do something like that, usurp the crown, just take the crown, well, they'd have to kill this baby as well now, because he's the legit heir, isn't he? Henry VI is the king. Now he's got a little baby boy. And so you'd have to murder him as well, wouldn't you? Or at least just keep him a prisoner forever. So it just complicates matters. It makes it more difficult. And that the queen, even if you did imprison, even if you did arrest and imprison the king, but the son is still at large, at liberty, even if he's a baby, a Lancastrian faction can be built up and around him. Very, very powerful Lancastrian magnates might say, oh, well, you've captured Henry VI. You've got him in your power. He's in the Tower under your lock and key. Or he's even dead. Well, now this new baby is the king, though, and we recognise him. And he will be the leader of our faction, even as a child. So in other words, the fact that the queen finally gave birth to particularly a son means that the whole aspect of everything does sort of change. Oman says, this completely cut away York's prospect of succession. Because if Henry VI did die for whatever reason, without any issue, then the legit next in line would be Richard Duke of York. But not, you know, not now, exactly as Oman says. But he, Richard Duke of York, accepted the situation with loyalty, and swore allegiance to the infant Prince of Wales. But after 18 months, Henry VI suddenly and unexpectedly recovered his sanity. As I said, just snapped out of it, literally. Like one day, snapped out of it. Owen tells us that at once, at Queen Margaret's behest, he, the king, dismissed York and his friends from office and drew Somerset out of the Tower to make him minister once more. So that's a classic thing that characterises the Wars of the Roses. A massive amount of volatility, a swing back and forth between the two sides. One moment it looks like one of the sides, the Lancastrians or the Yorks, have got complete dominance and have completely won it. And then suddenly, very suddenly, something happens, some event happens, usually a battle, but not always, which just completely flips the script. I mean, here, there you go. The king and Margaret of Anjou and someone like Somerset were just completely in control for 5 straight years there, just no problems. And then the king goes insane, flipped, York's in control, York's in charge, suddenly. 18 months later, the king snaps out of it, boom, the Yorkists are out of power. The Lancastrians are back in the seat. And, I mean, could it swing more violently one way than the other? Okay, but the Yorkists have had a taste of power now, and people like Somerset and Margaret of Anjou are going to hold a grudge. They're not going to be happy with the way they were treated, even though it wasn't too bad, considering how bad it gets. Like Richard, Duke of York, didn't just have them all murdered, did he? He put Somerset in the Tower, but he didn't kill him, didn't torture him, didn't have Margaret of Anjou killed or exiled or anything. Well, it gets as bitter as it could possibly get later. But they're not going to forget. Margaret of Anjou is not going to forget how she was treated. We hope you enjoyed that video. And if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.